Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of truly unearthing the past. This month, Chelsea is guest as well as partner because she is the co-editor of a new book, Chinese Diaspora Archaeology in North America. Chelsea, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, Chelsea's on the phone because we're keeping people out of the studio for the coronavirus duration. J. Ryan Kennedy is co-editor of the book with Chelsea. He's an adjunct professor in the Department of Archaeology at the University of New Orleans. Welcome, Ryan.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Laura Ng is with us as well. She's in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford University and one of the chapter authors in the book. Laura, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Good to have you all here. So somebody start us off. Chelsea, why don't you just give an overview of the Chinese diaspora and what spurred it?
Yeah, so this book really talks about the mass immigration of Chinese individuals from southern China to North America, and also we've kind of framed it in a way that acknowledges that folks were not only coming to North America, the traditional story is people came over to mine for gold in California and then the West, but folks were actually going all over the world to look for employment to send money back home to help support their families in southern China. And this global movement is really fascinating when you stand back a little bit and look at it in a larger sense and all the networks that were created across the world and continued into, you know, long into the occupation of immigrants across Oregon and places like that. So once we started looking at how all these sites are connected and the need to study these sites in a way that recognizes those connections between the home villages in China and all the places that Chinese migrants were going in the 19th and early 20th century, that's kind of the research that we're kind of focusing in this book and also encouraging folks to do going forward. So not just looking at an isolated gold mining camp in California, but thinking about how folks got there and the connections that they had across the world during that time.
So, J. Ryan Kennedy, you're the one person not on the West Coast. How wide a scatter was it from the Chinese diaspora?
You know, I think certainly worldwide, throughout the Pacific world, but if we just kind of focus in on North America, most of what we talk about in the kind of public history and even in scholarly work is really California and the American West, right? But I've got a colleague who's done work in New Orleans at a Chinese laundry, and we had over 1,000 Chinese immigrants right around the turn of the 19th century here in New Orleans. People were out throughout the American Southeast, New York. People were coming all over the country. I mean, it truly is a kind of worldwide and national scope, and it's something we don't often think about today.
Let's move into the discussion in the chapter that you wrote in the book. Wait, are you the same? Is it D. Ryan Gray or J. Ryan Gray?
No, so that is actually my colleague.
Okay.
But I do know that project fairly well. He's a colleague of mine. D. Ryan Gray is at University of New Orleans as well. So it's kind of confusing. Everyone's confused, us.
Sorry, I saw New Orleans and Ryan, and I jumped to a conclusion. My apologies there. But this is an interesting story about trying to be Chinese and in business in the Jim Crow South. So a bunch of complications, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And it's kind of a balancing act. And there's a whole really kind of wonderful body of history written about this period, but particularly in the South. And one of the things that you see is that Chinese people kind of occupy this space. They're neither black nor white. And in the South, people are very, very concerned. Emancipation, all these sorts of things. Like, what is the relationship between a quote-unquote black person and a quote-unquote white person, right? And Chinese people are there, and they don't really fit into either category. And so it both makes it very difficult for them, but it also gives them some flexibility. And so here you have a story of a person who was able to have a laundry, have a business, in a way that they kind of let them sort of navigate the middle ground between what was a very dicey situation at times between groups of people in the South.
So did the Chinese people in Jim Crow South have some more rights than black Americans had?
At times, but at the kind of flip side of this is that those rights weren't necessarily codified in law, right? People were very, very concerned about limiting the abilities of people who were, say, black from owning businesses in ways that they may not be able to if they were white. That doesn't necessarily mean that the legal right was there if you're Chinese. At the same time, you might kind of fly under the radar, so to speak. And so that's a lot of what we sort of see early on There's a lot of discussions of what citizenship even means, and this is at a national level, but it's particularly relevant in the South, where you have emancipation. You look at basically former plantation owners are looking for a labor force to continue to make the plantations run. And who do they turn to? Initially, they turn to Chinese people. And so there are these discussions about they are or are they not free laborers, right? And so eventually we kind of understand them as not enslaved people. And so that doesn't mean, though, that they're treated any better necessarily. Certainly in plantation context, it was pretty awful in the South. If you were Chinese on those kinds of they were still working plantations. I mean, I think technically they would be considered farms post-emancipation, but they were still plantations. And so it's hard to say on an individual level whether people had it better or worse. I think it's all shades of not good.
Huh. I think all shades of not good is a good phrase there. Laura Ng at Stanford University, your chapter is about between South China and Southern California, the formation of transnational Chinese communities. Were these people who moved back and forth, or did they come and stay, or how did this all work?
Yeah, it was actually both. But actually, the research I've been doing on the migrants who lived in Riverside and San Bernardino Chinatowns, this is in the Inland Empire mm-hmm. region of Southern California, so close to L.A., but more inland. And it was a very agricultural area because of irrigation had happened, and Chinese were leasing a lot of farms to grow vegetables that they would sell to locals. But then in these Chinatowns were created sort of forcibly because of exclusion earlier from the city centers.
Oh, so you get to live there, but not here.
Yeah. And so I think, these the people who lived in the Chinatown, a lot of them were merchants, but what I found looking at oral histories that I conducted and previously conducted ones, and also at these archival documents called Chinese exclusion files, we see how often people were moving back and forth. And one family, the descendants of Wang Sam, a merchant in the San Bernardino Chinatown, he went back to China 3 times to get married, to have his 2 sons. And so he actually died in the United States in 1938. But his intention was, even when he was after his burial, he wanted his bones to be sent back to China, which was the thing that was customary in Chinese American communities. And it never happened because of the war between Japan and China, which stopped any sort of communication between the two countries. But I think if that hadn't happened, if those world events hadn't happened, I think they would have the Chinese would have continued going back and forth between the U.S. and China. And this is this one family story is not unique. I've counted other immigrants in this region who've gone back 5 times to get married, to have children, to take care of business. So yeah, it's a fascinating story.
In Wang Sam's case, did he bring his wife back here, or did he bring his children here?
No, he did not bring his wife over.
Huh.
But and that was common, and I think there's debate among scholars about why that was. And one reason is because there was more scrutiny of Chinese women, and there was this idea that they were prostitutes, and so the U.S. government didn't want them to come over for that reason. And then another idea that scholars have is that Chinese men preferred to not have their wives come over because they always intended to go back to China and retire, so they wanted to keep have a normal family life as much as possible for their children. So I think that's also why they would go back and have children there. So I think it's really I think it's a combination of both in my opinion, that it was exclusion laws that forbade Chinese women essentially to come over, and also sort of like this idea of this, I'm going to go back to my home, to my wife, my kids. Yeah.
We are talking about, this is Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange, we're talking about the Chinese diaspora, which saw people scatter from southern China to many parts of the world, but we're talking about North America here because Chelsea Rose, our partner from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, is the lead editor of a book called Chinese Diaspora Archaeology in North America. Her partner, J. Ryan Kennedy, is on the line as well from the University of New Orleans, and you just heard Laura Ng from Stanford University. Join the conversation on the Exchange. Questions, comments about Chinese people in the United States, in fact, in all of North America during the 19th century, primarily, 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Ryan Kennedy, I have to believe there are like big conferences. There's a lot of Chinese diaspora archaeology going on. This book would indicate that.
Yeah, there certainly are. There, I think this is kind of a really a high point right now in Chinese diaspora archaeology. This is something that Chelsea and I have been heavily involved in. There's other folks at different universities who've been doing this work now for probably 10 to 15 years, I think, is really the kind of point of time in which it's started to have a major uptick in terms of the amount of work being done. Chelsea and I have organized sessions at, gosh, I don't know, at this point, four or five conferences, maybe more. It's all a blur at this point. but yeah, we try to do something every year, every other year at a conference to keep the momentum going. There's been a lot of work coming out of Stanford University through the Chinese Road Workers in North America project, which is a big interdisciplinary project that they've been doing. Barbara Voss, who's an archaeologist at Stanford, has been heavily involved in that. So there have been a number of conferences and gatherings around that. Chelsea, I, Laura as well, collaborate with folks at Wuyi University in Jiangmen, China. They're holding conferences as well, international scope on those conferences that include archaeologists like ourselves. So it's a really kind of academically exciting time to be doing this work. There's a lot of momentum and a lot of professional interest in it.
Laura, go ahead, Chelsea.
Also, other aspects of it, you know, people always think archaeology, we're just thinking about the past and there's no ties to the modern future. Well, a lot of this book explores the horrific implications of anti-Chinese sentiment towards Chinese peoples in the 19th and 20th century. And that's why it's so incredibly disappointing to have our president and other members of, you know, politicians calling the current coronavirus the Chinese virus or the China virus. You know, that's really, it's really promoting xenophobia and racism. And we all know where that can go when people are scared and feel vulnerable. And I just really hope people can think more critically and be cautious when they hear that kind of stuff and recognize that it's not, you know, that's not a healthy or fair way to think about the current situation we're in.
Yeah, the World Health Organization had specifically asked people not to stigmatize areas where diseases come from. And here we have people, members of Congress, including the president, talking about the Wuhan virus or the Chinese coronavirus. So, yeah, that's well said there, Chelsea. Laura Ng, you mentioned the Chinatowns in Riverside and San Bernardino. Do those still exist?
No, they don't. And, so the structures, some of them actually were still standing for the Riverside Chinatown, I think as late as the 1960s, and then there's at least one brick structure that was still standing, and then I believe also some brick structures standing in the 30s and 40s, but they weren't seen as places that we should preserve. And this could also be because at the time they were demolished, like they just in general, it was about redevelopment and not about preserving historic structures. But I think it's also because these structures were related to Chinese migrants, and that just wasn't important to anybody except for Chinese American, you know, groups at the time. So there was there were some preservationists that tried to save these buildings and talk about their importance, but it just it didn't convince anybody.
So Ryan Kennedy, that was kind of the point for the book, wasn't it? I mean, you and Chelsea, in one of the bits of supporting material for the book, talk about how the research is often mired in longstanding interpretive models that essentialize race and identity. You're trying to move beyond that.
Yep. Yeah, and it's something that I think happens in both kind of to Chelsea's earlier point, it happens in both the scholarly literature and in the discussions that we have at the academic level. But this also really very much extends into to popular thought about what it means to be Chinese in the 19th century or the modern world. And so one of the things that we're really hoping to do with this volume and the kind of discussions that the volume is going to spark are really is to get people to think about the nuance of people's lives, right? Yes, people are Chinese, they're coming over, they're making money, they're sending it back to their families, but the story has often been they're coming here, they're doing these things and they're leaving, and they're never really part of the quote-unquote American community, whatever that might be, or the fabric of America. And I think that we could all look around us and say that's not true, right? I mean, we have Chinese people here today who are the descendants of people who were here in the 19th century. Certainly the things, the monuments, the Transcontinental Railroad, if we want to call that a monument to Chinese immigration, which in some ways it really is, all of these things still exist around us. And so part of what we're trying to do is raise awareness of just the complexity of Western history in the U.S. and, as we talked about earlier, in other areas of the U.S. as well, the Southeast and elsewhere. And so, yeah, a lot of it was really trying to raise the profile of Chinese history in the U.S. so that people understand it. It's not something that even in the West, we don't always know about these things, that they really happened, that Chinese people played such an important role, that they still were here, that they became parts of communities, and so on. And I think that's really an unfortunate thing. We really have to have that complete view if we're going to understand the U.S. as it is today.
Chelsea, that is, you mentioned already that one of the aims here is to make sure that we understand some of this in modern Chinese context as well. So, I mean, are we talking about you potentially going off to Guangdong province and learning more about descendants of people who did live here?
I did. So, you know, I've been there. When we were over there, I went to one of the villages where Huacheng was a store in Ashland that was operated by Wang Guangsu, and he was the labor boss for the railroad for the Southern Pacific for 42 years, and he helped maintain the tracks. And so he also helped bring in dozens of folks and help them navigate the exclusion, the immigration laws during the early 20th century. And I realized all of them were coming from the same village cluster. So I went back there and actually went to the village, saw the buildings that were built with money sent back from Oregon, met the descendants. And that's also why Laura's research is so exciting, because she really is doing groundbreaking research to compare two populations that are connected over time and space. So the communities in California and the communities in this, again, the same kind of village cluster where a lot of those folks immigrated from and maintained connections with. So by doing that and by seeing two sides of this transnational story, I think we're going to get a much better idea of what it was like for folks living here, what their experience was, and also hear more of the story from their own perspective, because we're engaging with Chinese documents, not just newspaper accounts of Chinese people written by somebody else who might have been pretty biased. But we're getting a much more inclusive story, which is really exciting.
A living, breathing story, not just digging up stuff and trying to figure out what it was all about.
That's right.
The book is called Chinese Diaspora, Archaeology in North America, co-edited by Chelsea Rose and J. Ryan Kennedy. Ryan is adjunct professor in the Department of Archaeology at the University of New Orleans. Laura Ng is in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford University. Chelsea, of course, is our regular partner in underground history from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you, everybody. Stay safe.
Thank you.
Stay safe.